Chiarelli yesterday, whose book on Muslim Sicily only came out 18 months ago, and is the definitive English language work on the subject. And now we have Alessandra Marchi, who did her doctorate at the School of Higher Social Sciences in Paris, precisely on Sufism in Italy. I don't know how many people have done doctorates in Sufism in Italy, but they're very, very few, and we are really fortunate to have her with us. She flew yesterday from Sardinia. She lives in a small village right in the center of the island of Sardinia. Really, I have to pause for a minute. Some of you will remember from Alexandria last year, our friend Mohamed Kanawi, who is an archaeologist at the Bibliotheca Alexandrina. He took us to these beautiful ancient ruins of the Alexandrian school, where Leonard even thought it might be the original holistic center in a broad definition of the term. But anyway, it was Mohamed told me about Alessandra and her work in Sufism. So really, without our link there to Alexandria last year, there's no way you would have found Alessandra. So I'm really grateful for that connection that you gave us. Let me also say about Alessandra that her research interests include the development of Sufism in the West, especially in Italy, and the transformation of its rituals and traditions. Now, some of us were really fortunate enough in Alexandria last year, those of us who were staying to go on Cyprus, to be invited to a Sufi ritual way in the back streets of Alexandria with a group that had never had an English-speaking person there before. And for those of us who were there, very distinct, rhythmic, it seemed to me almost shamanic quality about it, unlike the Mevlevis in Turkey or the other Sufi brotherhood in Marrakesh that some of us were fortunate to be the guests of after the esoteric quest for the golden age of Andalusia. So ever since our conference in Granada Sufis, Kabbalists, and Christian philosophers in medieval Spain, we have maintained this exploration of the Sufi world and how it connects to the whole Western tradition as well, where it is overlapped with that. So I feel really very grateful and fortunate that Alessandra could be with us today. She's also working on the history of the Italian community in Egypt, at the Center for Alexandrian Studies in Alexandria. Remember that Alexandria, up until the Suez Crisis in the mid-50s, was a vastly cosmopolitan community with 300,000 Greeks, 50 or 70,000 Jews, 12,000 Brits, Italians, a hugely cosmopolitan world where that impulse where all the cultures, all the philosophies, all the religions of the world all flowed together, not only in ancient Alexandria, but right up until the mid-50s of the 20th century. So Alessandra is very connected to all of that. And it's a wonderful way to start the day, because we start off with this, and then later in the morning, Christopher McIntosh will speak to us about Frederick II, whose castle was Stupor Mundi, the wonder of the world, really one of the most remarkable figures of the 20th century. The 12th and 13th century. So I'm really grateful that Alessandra has come all the way over from Sardinia to be with us. As I say, she's one of the very, very few people who could speak on this rare topic. And we are truly privileged to have it here. So let's give a warm welcome to
Thank you very much for your presentation and for inviting me here. I'm very happy. to discover Syracuse as a, because it's a lovely city, and I think that we can better understand what was Sufism and Islam in Sicily, just walking around Syracuse. So, I started my interest in Sufism in Italy, in contemporary Italy, with some fundamental questions that were, is it possible to reveal the presence and the role of Islam and Sufism in Europe in its religious culture? And if are there sufficient sources, and can they really speak to us? Can we find enough important traces of Sufism legacy for Europeans to prepare them to the reception of Sufism in contemporary Europe and Italy, and more, so more generally in the West? Those are only some fundamental questions that started my interest in Sufism, and for which I had to find a historical answer to begin with. As this conference aims to demonstrate, the forgotten spiritual history of Sicily still needs to be explored, because Sicily is one of the most culturally intriguing and historically rich places in the world, which became a brilliant center of Arabic culture, with poets, geographers, esoteric knowledge, and Sufis and Kabbalists, and so on. So after that, the translation from Arabic into Latin and then into European languages later allowed the flow of information, influence, and re-elaboration of the ancient and medieval thought. But before going into the history of Sufism, we have to define Sufism. Sufism can be described broadly as the intensification of Islamic faith and practice, or the tendency among Muslims to strive for a personal engagement with the divine reality. The Arabic term Sufi, however, has been used in a wide variety of meanings over the centuries by both proponents and opponents of Sufism, which offered diverse interpretations of the term. Western observers normally refer to Sufism as Islamic mysticism or Islamic esotericism, but that's only a partial definition that can encourage people to consider as a non-Sufi anything that doesn't fit into those categories, and Sufism is all but categories. The word Sufism is commonly used to translate the Arabic term tasawwuf, which indicates the main esoteric dimension of Islam, by which, through multiple channels that are called the Sufi orders, tariqa in Arabic, disciples seek to achieve union with the gods of the Abrahamic monotheism. Already among the companions of the prophets, some sought to reconcile the inner religious experience with external acts and daily contacts, following a way of life dedicated to asceticism and poverty. So it wasn't at the beginning. The effort to reconcile inside and outside, that are called batin and zahir in Arabic, produced a spiritual discipline of deep knowledge beyond the letter and the appearance of the divine revelation received by the Prophet Muhammad, that he is considered an example of perfect human being. So who is the Sufi? From the Arabic root SWF, the mystic Sufi is the person designated by the term mutasawwif, an aspirant on the path of spiritual development, which makes integral part of the concept of Sufism. The original sense of Sufi seems to have been one who wears wool. In the 8th century, the word was sometimes applied to Muslims whose ascetic inclinations led them to wear coarse and uncomfortable woolen garments. But other basic dimensions are important in Sufism, such as proximity to Allah, so proximity to God, and his friends, the Wali in Arabic, who are closest to him for crossing steps and stations of spiritual growth. In this regard, the concept of closeness to God, the walaya, approaches to the concept of holiness, but which differs from the same concept in Christianity. But again, the Sufi vocabulary is rich in complex meanings that inspires a great reflection in the doctrine of Islam. Gradually, it came to designate a group of disciples who differentiated themselves from the others by stressing certain teachings and practices of the Quran and the Sunnah. The Sunnah is a collection of sayings and practices of the Prophet, and is the, one of the main sources of law in Islam. By the 9th century, the term from Tasawwuf was adopted by some representatives of this group as an appropriate designation of their own beliefs and practices. And then other terms were and continue to be used, like Sufis, disciples, fakirs, and so on. The knowledge that is considered in Sufism is basically a science of the heart, dedicated to the inner knowledge, the ilm al-batin, where the love of God, mahabba, occupies a central place, which is particularly valid in contemporary Sufism, and it suggests the main key to understand its success in the West today. Sufis generally stress contemplation over action, spiritual development over legalism, and cultivation of the soul over social interaction. That is important too, of course. The Sufi experience is intuitive, but at the same time, it's built on methods and rules of spiritual discipline, which have their sources in the Quran and the interpretation of the hidden sense of the Quran, and in the master-disciple relationship. From which Sufi traditions and paths derive. So the Sufi orders derive from a teaching of a Muslim saint or Sufi master. This shows us immediately the richness and the pluralism inside Sufism. And in fact, Sufism has also been associated with an enormously rich spiritual literature, poetry, and music. And this is also one of the reasons because the opponents don't love the more conservative and orthodox Muslims, don't often love Sufis. Given the difficulty of defining Sufism, it's not easy to declare which Muslims have been Sufis. And this is an important point to note for our subject today. If there was no phenomenon called Sufism at the time of the Prophet and in the early Middle Ages, neither was there anything called fiqh or kalam, so jurisprudence and theology in the later sense of these terms. In contrast, Muslim opponents of Sufism have been asked to show that Sufism is a distortion of Islam, and they have every say upon any opportunity to associate Sufism with disbelief and moral laxity. But Sufi training invites spiritual growth, invites to cultivate an ethic that is reflected in the teaching, who knows himself, knows his Lord. And finally, it invites the cultivation of knowledge as the goal of religion and spirituality. And this knowledge is a fundamental component of human perfection. In historical terms, it's useful to think of Sufism on two levels. On the first level, which is the primary focus on the Sufi authorities themselves, Sufism has no history, in the sense that it's the invisible, inside and life-giving force of the Muslim community. On the second level, which concerns both Muslim authors and modern historians, Sufism's presence is made known through observable characteristics of people in society and in specific institutions that are the Sufi orders, following the teaching of the Sufi master. So we have to consider these two levels as both fundamental in understanding why so little Sufism has appeared to have been passed onto our culture and spirituality. To better understand what Sufism represented in Italy and in the West more generally, it's important to review the history, including our Italian Islamic past. A knowledge of Islam has existed in Europe for many centuries. If Arab Muslim Spain is the main source of what has been circulated in Islam in the West in medieval times, we mustn't overlook the role of South Italy in this process, and especially Sicily. The flourishing trade in the fields of philosophy and science, and also in religious traditions, are evidenced by the names of Thomas Aquinas, Albert the Great, Avicenna, Averroes, Al-Ghazali, Al-Biruni, Michael Scott, and those others that from Europe to the Arab countries and Central Asia transformed the human way of thinking and their activities. So in the Middle Ages, East and West, Christian, Jewish and Muslims were as much as in contact for exchanges as for conflict. The Islamic conquest of Italy took place in the wake of the conquest of Spain, but the first offensive began in Sicily and in Sardinia from the 7th and 8th centuries, with incursions and raids most often. And at this time, the conflict between Italian principalities were common in our peninsula, as well as alliances of opportunity were often established with foreign powers. In the 9th century, the Lombard prince Radelchi allied with the Berber chief Calfun in Sardi in Puglia, who has rarely been mentioned in historical sources. Calfun conquered Bari, in the south of Italy, in Puglia, probably between 847 and 48, and he was its emir until 852. After Taranto, so Bari was the first city to be conquered in order to create a stable base, and probably the only one to become a small Islamic state, comparable to Muslim colonies of Maghreb and Spain, and politically independent, even independent from Muslims in Sicily. So in 853, Mufarrar ibn Salam became the second emir of Bari, and then we have a third emir, who was Sardwan, until 865, when the Lombard prince Ludwig began his expedition to the Emirate of Puglia to conquer Bari definitely in 871. So the experience of this little emirate of Bari and Tartu is very interesting to note, especially as it has not received much attention from historians, who were of course more interested in Muslim Sicily because of a more significant and long-term presence. The first attacks against Sicily seems to date back to 652, and there were many others then, until the Aglabids were invited to take over the island by the Byzantine Eupharius, so that the emir Ziyadat Allah finally decided to land at Mazara in 827. So the first victory was here in Syracuse in 828, and in 830 it was the turn of Palermo. Then the Fatimids and the Taldis succeeded in taking control over the island, but uprising started in Sicily during the 10th century. Up until in 1072, Palermo was taken over by Robert Guiscard, the brother of the Norman Count Roger I of Hauteville, who began the reconquest of the island, firstly taking Messina in 1061. Finally, the island became Christian again, and after more than two centuries of a slow but deep conquest, it was actually populated by Arabized and Islamized natives. There were many revolts then, as the initiative of Sicilian Muslims. The revolt in the city of Lucera in 1223 deserves to be mentioned because it was the last table bulwark of Sicilian Muslims sent to this northern city of Puglia by the Norman King Frederick II of Hohenzollern. Lucera dei Saraceni, as it was called, was a colony where Muslims lived freely for almost a century. There were about 20,000 of them, and when they were forced to convert in the early 13th century. The Angelis dynasty at least temporarily preserved this Muslim community. Charles II of Anjou integrated Muslims in his administration, but the King of Naples favored the mission of the Catalan priest Raymond Lull to accelerate the Christianization of these populations, which finally arrived in force during the dispersal of the colony of the Chair in August 1330. In 1294, Charles II of Anjou ordered to the captain of Lucera dei Saraceni to constrain those who convert from Christianity to Islam to come to the inquisitor of the kingdom to be reconciled with the charge. Maybe these Italians remained Muslims in their hearts, but it's only conjecture, which doesn't allow any conclusion about the possible extension of Islam in southern Italy after that time. Despite the fact that conversion of Christian to Islam in southern Italy has remained an important phenomenon for a long time. This is another interesting aspect to consider in the study of Sufism. The Sicilian Ethiopians' relationship became increasingly difficult. Raising piracy in the Mediterranean continued over the following centuries, bringing about the cancellation of the Muslim history of southern Italy. Nonetheless, Palermo profited enormously from the Islamic culture and still retains traces in architecture, language, literature, and food, as of Sicily. But can we speak of a Muslim heritage? Before the 10th century, several Mediterranean cities knew a great social cultural diversity. The Iraqi traveler Ibn Halkar discovered Palermo in 973 as one of the largest cities in the Western Mediterranean, with more than 300,000 inhabitants and hundreds of mosques, like it was in Cordoba in Spain. In Sicily, Arabic became for a period of time a popular and even official language. The Arabization and the Berberization of the area were ethnically and linguistically very deep due to the trade and Philo-Islamism of the Norman court and the necessary language skill for communication between Italy and North Africa during the Middle Ages. But normally, outside the professional context, Arabic was not very common. The integration of different cultures who inhabited together the island for several centuries had been more apparent than real, because community divisions were quick to divide the Sicilian society. Sicily therefore contributed to the intellectual life of Islam, including in the Maghreb. Grammar study, philology, theology, and law flourished, and poetry found its place of election in the Calvin court of Palermo and in the Norman court, and in small local emirates. However, the Sicilian Arabism could soon perish. According to this Italian historian Francesco Gabrielli, suggested but unproven hypothesis is that some underground link could combine the extreme manifestations of the Arab-Islamic spirituality, so Sufism also, of the island, with those examples of lyrical romance in Italy. The cultural vitality of the court of Frederick II is well known, even if interpretations of it sometimes diverge. Example of tolerance or not, this Norman king made his court a place of election of Aristotelian studies through Avicenna and Averroes, especially since the arrival in Palermo in 1227 of the Scottish philosopher and physician Michael Scott. Michael Scott seemed to sum up the lively activity of translators from Arabic of the 12th and the 13th centuries. He had already translated the famous Kitab al-Hayya, the treatise on the sphere of Nuruddin Abu Ishaq Vitruvi, that Westerners could know as Al-Bekhajan, in which the motions of the sun and the planets were explained in a way that corresponded with Aristotelian physics. Scott then translated from Greek and Arabic other Aristotelian treatises, and it must be thanks to him that Sicily became a place of choice for the study of Aristotle. However, many filtered to Ibn Sina, so Avicenna, and Ibn Rushd, Averroes. Concerning specifically Sufism, Frederick II had also stimulated research on the most diverse scientific and cultural areas, including the work of the Murshid mystic Ibn Sabin, that is called Al-Masa'i al-Siciliya, the Book of the Sicilian Issues. Ibn Sabin was born in the kingdom of Murcia around 1216 and 17. He was called Sheikh al-Sabiniyya from the name of the tariqa formed around him. So there was a sort of Sufi school. We can't speak of a Sufi order in this period, but it was a sort of Sufi path from the name of Ibn Sabin. He grew in prosperity. He studied Arabic, literature, science, and philosophy. He adhered to Sharia and Sufism, and he also studied wild magic and the science of names and letters, medicine and alchemy. In 1232, he left to Murcia with his disciples, apparently because the Fuqaha, the jurists, began to hunt him for his Sufi ideas and statements considered as heretical. It seems that they stopped in Ceuta, where he married a rich woman who gave him sustenance and a home, including a Sufi lodge called Zawiya in Arabic. The governor of Ceuta also asked Ibn Sabin to answer the questions required by Frederick II. But it seems that because of his philosophical ideas, the Sufi was forced to leave the city. He composed many of his works, but the jurists of Tunis still accused him, and he had to leave in 1254. He stopped in Cairo, where Sufi masters and Andalusians were welcomed, but his ideas steeped in philosophy were not well received or more understood again. So he went to Mecca, and he was not really appreciated here, so he started diplomatic efforts and failed to get back to the Maghreb. But the Fatimid governor, Humay Abu Muhammad I, offered him support and protection. But according to some biographer, Ibn Sabin lived in easy and safety, practicing Sufism. On the contrary, for others, more obscure news was collected because of his ideas and beliefs. So Ibn Sabin believed that the prophecy should be acquired as an emanation that overflows when the intellect is pure. Multiple versions circulated on the date of his death in 1270 by suicide, poisoning, or more probably by natural death. Ibn Sabin read Ibn Tufayl, Ibn Rushd, Ibn Sina, Al-Farabi, that was the only one that he considered a real philosopher, but he criticized them as imitators of the doctrines of Aristotle. He believed they were all insufficient for spiritual realization, and he surely knew the gospel, Christianity, Jewish currents and their lyrics, Brahmanical and Hindu schools, as well as the Hermetic and Persian schools. The fundamentalist, conservative fundamentalist Ibn Taymiyyah and also Ibn Hatib reported that Sabin excelled in the Shubhiyya Tariqa, which mixed a school that mixed Hellenistic thought with Sufism. But because of his theory of the absolute oneness of God, he was accused of getting away by the Sharia. So as we can see, it was not easy to distinguish between Orthodox and heterodox Islam, and so between Islam and Sufism. The Tariqa Sabiniyya, so from the name of Ibn Sabin, stands out among the disciples and mystics of Damascus, named by the French scholar Louis Massignon, the Sabinians de Damas, so the Sabinians from Damascus. But what about the Sicilian book? So we don't know the issues asked by the Emperor Frederick, but they are indirectly inferred from the responses. So the first question, there were five questions, five issues. The first one related to a topic of Aristotelian metaphysics and its evidence in the favor of the eternity of the universe. The second one concerned the pupils and the conditions of the theology of the ancient Greeks and Sufis. The third concerned the meaning and the number of Aristotelian categories. The fourth trial concerned the immortality of the soul and the differences between Aristotle's theory and that of Alexander of Aphrodisias. The fifth question bordered in the field of the emperor's curiosities, such as what was the meaning of the statement, "The heart of the believer is between two fingers of the merciful." This is a hadith traditionally attributed to Muhammad, or is this supposed? The Arab scholar Abu Rida did a philosophical examination of this text, following a deeper research that has troubled the mind of philosophers, but giving the opportunity for intellectual contact between the enlightened Christian emperor and the wise men of Islam. The Danish Orientalist Meren, following the suggestion by the Sicilian historian Michele Amari, who first discovered the Sicilian issues manuscript, considered that Ibn Sabin showed in his book the true way for salvation, Frederick II, by a Sufi method. He thought that mysticism was present in Jewish, Christian, and Muslim traditions because of its Neoplatonist and Oriental roots that Ibn Sabin surely knew and used. Sabine based his doctrine on the Aristotelian and mystical philosophy, in fact. It seems that Sabine refused the gift that Frederick II wanted to offer him in exchange for his answers, because his interest was motivated by the desire of a victory of Islam in Sicily. The value of the Sicilian issues rests, therefore, in the encounter and dialogue between different cultures, mentalities, and religions. This manuscript represented a major dialogue in the aim to deepen the essential truths, despite different religious views, and it has been well studied and diffused, even if it was not translated in full into a European language. We have only some questions, some issues that have been translated. Sicily became at the time so the main point where West encounters East and Islam in East Europe. It was characterized by an interesting atmosphere of openness and tolerance, thanks also to the common spirit of Frederick II and Ibn Sabin, a common spirit of love for research, knowledge, and the truth. Many historians study and reflect on the political, cultural, and spiritual life of Frederick II. Was not only pro-Muslim, but a key player of the Mediterranean culture that binds the three worlds profoundly, Christian, Muslim, and Jewish. Their common roots are in two specific traditions who have met and merged in a complex way between the 2nd century before Christ and the 11th century after Christ. So the monotheistic tradition, originally linked to the patriarch Abraham, and the philosophical scientific tradition, defined in the West as Alexandria or Hellenistic, which arose from the experience of Alexander the Great and his successors, and of which the Roman Empire was heir. But finally, Islam and the Arabs were phased out because it suited to the Norman governors. So after that common ground, can we speak about a mystical literature? At the time of the Crusades, Italians admired the level of culture of the Muslim peoples, the way that their princes governed, the virtues of the Sultan, and at the same time they despised the degeneration of the church. And this is one of the reasons for improving their knowledge of alternative spiritual traditions. Before the Middle Ages, Muslim thinkers and their works, as well as some doctrines at the margins of their theology, seem to be known in Europe. Tales of popular piety of the Islamic world circulated among Europeans, who considered them wrongly as part of Islamic belief. Maybe they were popular tales invented in the West because fantasy elements have been mixed into them as they circulated. Yet there was literature written and spoken relating to the chapters of the Quran and various prodigies which have acquired values and meanings of mystical symbolism. So it was for stories on the purification of the heart of Muhammad or the doctrine of Muhammadan light, Nur Muhammadiyya in Arabic, dating back to the 8th century. So beliefs and myths, stories and concepts passed from one field to another between East and West, and among scholars around the world. But the question that arises is whether, among so many translated texts, notably in intellectual or clandestine milieus, at least some of the esoteric Islamic tradition works had also been included. But if mystical texts were translated, they probably circulated secretly, because of the danger in being discovered by the authorities, the Inquisition, or even Muslims, Muslim authorities, because they were not always in favor of the mystics. I like the assumption that Sufi texts circulated because many arguments were common to medieval tradition of the East and West. But then, I wonder, were these texts among the first to be burned? By their own readers, even, in order to avoid the death sentence. Or it may be that mystical knowledge was only transmitted orally, in order to maintain secrecy and mystery, and only among the elites of the initiated to the esoteric tradition, Muslim or Christian even, esoteric tradition. So maybe we are going to speak about a missed story of Tasawwuf, of Sufism. Her real interest in Sufism raised later in the colonial era with the Orientalist studies, who informed us about its origin in Europe. The word Sufi and Fakir initially appear in the accounts of travelers from the Middle Ages. These travelers encountered, probably on their way, some ribads, zawiyas, or other places of religious sociability, especially since the 12th century. So the Dominican Raymond Lull spoke of the Sufis because they were even in Europe, as evidenced by the great Sheikh Ibn al-Arabi in Andalusia. The Italian Dominican Ricoldo da Montecroce described in his itinerarium the Sufis of Baghdad, and he condemned their diabolic practices, probably the Sufi zikr, ecstatic dances and rituals. He thought of the holy Muslims as falsely religious compared to the Christian truth and tradition. He was shocked and horrified by his representation derived from Christian's imagery, which, however, could recognize the religious, the fuqara. But according to Ricoldo, they were so desperate in Baghdad that they wanted to end their lives by walking barefoot on fire just to be admired. So he didn't recognize the mystic symbol of this ritual to walk on fire. Travel stories have always been a very rich and important source about Sufism in Europe. The first mention of a Sufi Naqshbandi from the Naqshbandiya order in the European source was published in Italy in 1533. It was the journeys in Persia by the ambassadors Contarini and Bagaro that related a trip to Persia in 1487. The descriptions of these travelers and pilgrims certainly reflected some eccentricities or the miraculous powers of some dervishes they met. But normally, references to Sufism were scarce and imprecise, which is surprising, says the French Sufi scholar Michel Choquelis, because Sufism was pervasive among Muslims living on the borderline of Christendom. Our research, faced with a seeming lack of translations of Sufi literature, that is just surprising. The Risala, the classical manual of Al-Kushayri, a mystic of the 11th century, which was widely read by the Andalusian Sufis, was not translated in the Middle Ages. And the works of Ibn al-Arabi began truly circulating a few centuries after his death, so in the 14th-15th centuries. One of the last Muslim authors to be translated was our Sufi Ibn Sabi, which was one of the favorite targets of the fundamentalist theologian Ibn Taymiyyah, because of his Sicilian issues mentioned before. Raymond Lull knew Ibn Sabin and other dervishes and Sufi works, but he never mentioned them. So that his contribution to the reception of Sufism in the West could be apparently minimum. Authors like Maître Eckhart or Pico della Mirandola never cited the Sufi mystics, even if they presented more than one analogy with the Muslim spiritual thought. The assumptions of affiliation and influences between European and Muslim, Jewish and Christian thought are very plausible, precisely because of a common culture, which then developed through the need to think over the relationship of man to God. Jewish writers open to Sufism were also cultural mediators between the two worlds. Michel Choquelis again guesses at a possible path in oral or written form that through the thousands of Spanish conversos, so why not to Italian renegades, too, passed to an Islamic or Islamized literature in Europe. There are significant suggestions for this direction, particularly evidenced by the translation of treatise on Sufism written in Judeo-Arabic by members of the Maimonides family. The famous Moses Maimonides, Jewish contemporary and countryman of Averroes, wondered the same questions on the reconciliation between philosophy and revelation. This type of speculation will then lead to the separation between theology and philosophy, and gradually to what Henri Corbin called metaphysical secularization, which causes the duality of belief and knowledge. While very little of Sufism seems to have infiltrated the European medieval culture, at least in appearance, the spirituality didn't correspond to any precise expectations, says Pierre Lory, another French scholar. It's possible that Sufism was not really distinguished from the Orthodox Islam of the time, not only by these Christians interested in refuting Islam, but inside the Muslim world too. We also have to note that, at the beginning of the Christian Middle Ages, mystical brotherhoods were at their first stage of creation. So the spiritual teachings of the Sufi sheikh was done secretly, so as not to evoke among the authorities the suspicion of heresy that frequently touched many mystics in the East. The Persian mystic Allaj and other Sufis were tortured or condemned to death, and it seems likely that the news of such events circulated among travelers and pilgrims too. We have to say that the artworks translated in the Middle Ages were not all preserved, so we don't know how many of them or which were translated, but surely more than those known. In his study of the Divine Comedy, the Spanish scholar of Sufi Islam, Asim Palacios, noted that all invited Dante Alighieri, maybe our authors, to silence about sources that were difficult to reveal, because far from the general level of scholarship of his contemporaries. Moreover, there have been assumptions of the inspiration of Andalusian Sheikh Ibn Arabi, a leading figure of mystical Islam, and the direct influence of Muslim eschatology for whole passages of Dante's Divine Comedy. This is especially shown by the Liber Scalema Commenti, the Book of Ascension, a popular Muslim collection which recounts the night journey of the Prophet Muhammad that, according to Islamic tradition, he took during a single night around the year 621. And it has been described as both a physical and spiritual journey. This probable influence on Dante has stimulated various interpretations. Despite the similarities and analogies that Palacios sought to demonstrate and actually exist between the two books. According to the Italian historian of Islam, Enrico Cerulli, who was interested in the diffusion of the Book of Ascension in Italy, this is the only text on Islamic vision that Dante could have known, the only vulnerable to influence his comedy, because he excludes for him the consultation of scholastic Arabic literature. So there are literary themes that seem to have moved across religious borders. The diffusion in Europe, including Italy, of the Book of Ascension made known to the Christian public a popular version of the traditional story of the mirage of the Prophet, so the journey of the Prophet. But still, this book doesn't reveal, to either Dante or his contemporaries, a text that would have been written by a Sufi, where specific details of the interpretation of the mirage could convey to Sufis. Asim Palacios, on the contrary, considers here a direct Akbarian influence from the name of Sheikh Al-Akbar ibn al-Arabi, that means the great sheikh, but for which he refers to Christian roots. Hypotheses are always open, even that of a lack of distinction or curiosity about the more spiritual aspects of Islam. Islam itself was not considered at the time as an independent religion, but often as an heresy derived from a misinterpretation of the Christian message or the fabrication by an imposter. And besides, Palacios himself, while emphasizing the possible direct use of Islamic sources by Dante, said that is the divine religion, Christianity, a perennial source of poetry and spirituality, which ultimately gives us the general key of Dante's poem and its precursors, both Christian and Muslim. Because Islam, we have to say it once and for all, is the bastard son of Moses' law and the gospel. So prejudices were very strong in this period. So So his thesis of a Christianized Islam, from the title of another book of Asim Palacios, Christianized Islam, which would have been Sufism, has not convinced many other Islamic scholars. His thesis also suggests a distinction between Islamic Sufism and the underground idea of the autonomy of Tasawwuf, of Sufism, in relation to Islam, has been increasingly present in the West since this period. Tracing the history of the reception of Sufism in Europe, indeed, is in the end a very difficult task. The absence of ancient sources, but also for the successive transformation that Sufism has acquired in its most recent extensions in the West. If at first this book concerns historians of Islam, we must at least wonder about this history, because intimate relations between the two cultures, Islamic and European, have existed for several centuries, inviting us to further studies openings included. The need for uniformity in medieval Europe was built following a doctrinal conformity and a clear demarcation of boundaries in relation to the other, in this case to Islam. Thus, it was more comfortable to imagine the Arab world as different rather than similar to the European world. And it was easier to think of it as a sum of heresies in relation to Christianity. The construction of a radical otherness of Islam cannot be without connection on the concealment of certain sources and religion and religious and spiritual influences, which were presumably conceived as dangerous to the good Christian that the church was shaping. All these questions are intriguing, but so far the research has not informed us more about them. And fascinating speculation that remains still unanswered stimulates further research on the Mediterranean world. In this borderline area of communication and opposition, the influence of Islam on European culture remains undeniable, even when it was direct or indirect. The Italian scholar Alessandro Bauzani, like other Islamic scholars, agrees in the allocation of a common culture between Islam and Christianity during the Middle Ages. Fractures came after, and the reasons for division, as well as for diverse processes of fascination, lie in a long and complex history made of numerous omissions and perpetual contradictions. Sufism seems to have captured very little attention from scholars, travelers, and missionaries who produced much knowledge about Islam in Europe, so that we should seek the side of literal and philosophical means. Despite its presence in the Mediterranean and medieval Andalusia. We can say that finally that Sufism was preserved in secret, remaining almost unknown in Europe until the 20th century. This synthesis of relations between Italy and the Muslim Middle East aims to highlight the most important episodes in recent history in relation to the knowledge and understanding that has developed on Islam and Sufism in particular, the greatly absent for a long time on this soil. These centuries were fundamental to the advancement of knowledge about Sufism. The work of researchers in the 19th century let texts and Sufi themes circulate, certainly in a more objective, aesthetic, or even exotic interest, but still without achieving the enrichment produced during the medieval and humanist era. And according to Michel Chokiewicz, this late discovery of Tasawwuf by the West has, in respect to that of Arabic philosophy in the Middle Ages, a significantly high contrast. The question how the West could have received and understood so much slowly and partially the scope and importance of Sufism to the history of human thought. If Sufism was to be found everywhere in the lives of Muslims on the outskirts of the medieval Christianity, then it seems very difficult for the two spiritualities, Muslim and Christian, never to have met and influenced each other. Beyond the community divisions. In a way, the history of the reception of Sufism in the West is the story of a missed opportunity, according again to Michel Chokiewicz, a missed opportunity that we are still seeking to recover. So I'm going to my conclusions that what will be interesting to see later is the part of the myth and that probably will be told in relation to a European and Italian Islam. We are going to rebuild a mythical historical past. Is there going to be a reconstruction of events to revitalize the origins or a golden age of Italian Islam? I think the Arab Sicily and Renaissance cultural roots maintain a special interest for followers of Sufism as well as for Sufi fans like me and many of you. Thank you very much.
She did not mention etymology, right?
No.
I'm wondering what your opinion is about whether Frederick II was himself secretly a Sufi.
Maybe there are some problems that we can answer. I'm not sure that he was a Sufi. I think that the oddness of this period and of this thought, it was the response. I mean, it was really open to all traditions, and of course, it was influenced by Islamic thought and maybe Sufism for the part that he knew, and surely he knew some Sufi treaties. But I don't
think that he was a Sufi. But it's my opinion. Who knows? I may have missed this, but did you address the etymology of the word Sufism? Is it based on Sophia? The
No.
No, okay.
No.
Can you
explain? Some scholars spoke about this, the term Sophia. For the etymology of the term, but it's not the right one. The right etymology is about word. I don't know. Maybe I don't pronounce in a good way. No? The word garments that they wear, that they used to wear, and that in Arabic is suf.
Suf. And could you explain again what suf?
It's a sort of dressing that they put, that they wear.
Okay.
Just to symbolize some poor dresses.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Would you describe the Sufism as a science or practices?
Not precisely. So, Sufism is the science of the heart. So, Sufis want to discover what's behind the letter, what is the inner meaning of a letter.
Why don't they use the letters and do they use divine names in their practices?
Yeah. But those are cultural traditions sometimes, or not everywhere Sufis deepen in this sort of knowledge, but it's quite often diffused. Yeah.
And they saw the Prophet as being the divine man.
Mm-hmm. But
in fact, didn't they? Mohammed, did they see Mohammed as being a perfected man?
He's the prophet, Muhammad, of course, and he's considered in Sufism what they say, internal family, the perfect man.
Perfect.
So it's the example of a perfection that every Sufi follower has to follow, not imitate, because it's not a good concept, but they have to take example from the life and the spirituality of the Prophet Muhammad, who is considered perfect because he has done all the steps and mystical stations for the union to God.
So would Sufism be kind of viewed as a vertical ascent into heavenness as compared to that kind of a horizontal following through the commandments of the Quran?
There are hot dimensions in Sufism. As you have many Sufi traditions, there are Islamic context, in the religion external sense. Other traditions ask to follow Islam, even in an Orthodox way, but they really care less about the Orthodox Islam. Mm-hmm. And there was another aspect that is very interesting, that when we look at historical Sufism, we had a sort of elite of people, so we can consider a vertical dimension in this sense. And we had a popular dimension, that is the most diffused Sufism that we know, the Sufi brotherhood, Sufi rituals, and prayers, and chants, and dances that are not appreciated from the Orthodox Islam.
Yes, was there an antecedent Judaism to Islam, and was there a Greek influence there, or just... Yes. I mean, was there an antecedent Judaism to, in Pulse to Islam?
So we can't speak about Greek influence in the part of chaos. Sufism is the mystical dimension. So we can consider that Sufism has in common with other mysticism and esoteric tradition many aspects and many dimensions. So of course there is something about the Greek philosophy. Yes, there is a big part of Greek philosophy that circulated inside Sufi thought, but not a direct, I mean, it's not a direct consequence of we have many Sufi scholar or Muslim scholar that translated the Greek philosophy, so we can find a reciprocal influence more than a direct influence.
Could you talk about the mystical exercises, for instance, and music and dance that were practiced in the East, and whether that was were practiced in Sicily as well, the dervish, or the structure of the music?
Yeah, I can't say if they were practiced in Sicily. I think that where Sufi were, there were some Sufi rituals. But Sufi rituals differ from one country to another, from one tariqa to another. The main Sufi ritual is called zikr. That is the repetition of the name of Allah. And with some sentences like La ilaha illallah, there is no God but God. Because in Sufism, the main one of the main principles is that of the oneness and unicity of God. So the repetence of the name of Allah, the zikr, its aim is to conduct people to a different state of consciousness.
Right.
It was translated as trance or ecstasy. It's a Western concept, trance or ecstasy, but it approaches the significance of a different state of mind and consciousness. And normally, the zikr could be done just inside. There is a zikr called kalbi from the heart, or more generally, dances or rituals are played in with the breath. Of course, they have to turn and pronounce la 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 many times, but they go to a sort of trance, if you can say that. And many times we have instruments, musical instruments played for those rituals. Mm-hmm. But if you have the image of the whirling dervishes, for example, you can't find them outside Syria or Turkey, of course, and maybe Egypt, but we are not diffused because this order, the Mevlevia order, is not still a real tradition. Now it's a sort of folkloristic dance.
Was music, music was important to the Sufi state of consciousness, was it not?
Yes.
And how was that, how would you describe the harmonic structure of that in terms of what brought up entrancement, for instance? And what it brought, how the music structure and harmonic structure would bring about the state of trance. Mystical practice.
I can't answer to this question because I am not a specialist of the Sufi ritual in itself. But it's very important because Sufis, on the contrary of Orthodox Muslims, for example, or very conservative Muslims, consider that the Prophet Muhammad loved music. And it's an important tradition because they say that Prophet Muhammad didn't like perfume or music, and it's not true because we have hadiths on this sense that the Prophet Muhammad liked music. So part of that, every Sufi brotherhood has a different musical tradition. So I can't answer precisely on the musical structure.
Thank you.
Find women because there are many traditions that are still considered heterodox in respect to the main tradition. So we have Alevi groups where they are Shia, Shia groups more than Sufi one, but they have many things in common with Sufism, and they participate together, men and women mixed, without a separation. But I, in Istanbul, I attended many Sufi ceremonies, and the only one that I observed with women was the Mevlevia. But in this group, there is an American woman who is getting the tariqa and its diffusion. Or she's trying to maintain this Mevlevia tradition, because after Ataturk decision to don't allow any Sufi ceremony and any Sufi tariqa, they had to change their form, and many of Sufi brothers became music or cultural organizations. So they continue to attend Sufi ceremonies in a form that is different from the original tradition, or apparently different. Mm-hmm. But it's more folklore. You can attend a Sufi ceremony at the Galata Museum, and this is what they consider the heritage of the Mevlevia today, that is considered that tradition.
I was wondering whether, I know you talked about how Christianity sort of marginalized Sufism, and there was an effort to create more division. But was there any way, were there any ways that you're aware of that Sufism did creep into sort of Christian traditions on a popular level here in Italy or Sicily?
Yeah, maybe. Christian charge was more to exclude Islam, not really Sufism. So maybe sometimes they didn't distinguish between Muslims and Sufis. But in general, and until today, Sufism is considered the good phase of Islam, the positive way of Islam, and the way of Islam that is more approaches to, that is more close to Christianity. So it's possible that at the popular level, Sufism was diffused. Also because not only the medieval times, but also in the Renaissance, or even until the 20th century, in many countries, where there is a saint, for example, Muslims and Christians, or Hindus, or other followers of different traditions, consider the holiness, a unique holiness, so they can get to the, they can attend to the same ceremony, just because this man or woman is a saint, and the saint is recognized, as it was in the East Europe, in the Eastern Europe, it's really frequent that they share the main Sufi shrine, not Sufi, saint, Christian or Muslim saint shrines and tombs. So if you go to Sarajevo next year, maybe you can find a mixed religiosity, even if times are changing, so it would be more difficult than before.
Could you say that the Sufism, Mysticism, and Kabbalah were exactly what unites three religions? Religion being the outer part of a more fixed and exoteric approach, which can be very, very different in its form, but which finds a harmony in whenever you overcome it and start to the vertical way, and then you come to something which, by definition, is recognizable by inner religion, I would say, like Kabbalah, Sufism, and Gnosticism.
Yeah.
Which is interesting is that all the three are being prosecuted by their respective organism, as we say, to say about that. And perhaps they were more intelligent, the
because they didn't really write anything down, and they were more difficult to prosecute than Gnostics, for example, or I don't know.
Yeah, I think that this esotericism is the main key to dialogue and to share the inner meaning of each religion. I think so. And this is why I was so fascinated by Sufism when I started to study it. Because I think that really religions differ by their forms, but inside they share the same message. And if they concentrate more on this message, maybe we will have better times.
Could be a basis of financial and logical consequences.
Can I clarify what you said about Ataturk? Because he's a hero, and he forbade the wearing of the veil by the women. And so I found it very interesting that you said that he, making it a more tolerant, democratic country, that he forbade the mystical tradition. So this is surprising, because in Rumi's shrine, there are hundreds and hundreds of whirling Sufis mm-hmm. that came to worship, and there was a very, very tolerant acceptance of other religions. And there were Jews selling, there were Jews who were accepted, and there were, so it seems like, at least in the past, I know it's becoming more conservative, but it seemed very much in the Alexandrian spirit. There were Jews and there were Christians, and the guards let us all go through. Yeah, and okay. So can you address that?
I think it's a problem with secularization. When you want to decide by an authoritarian way what is secularism and what is religion and what you can attend from religion, you have a risk. And in Turkey, they had a risk. Ataturk did many good things, but in this way, maybe it was wrong. Because you want to just to impede a conservative way of living religion. He thought that superior orders and world religion was just something from the past or a conservative tradition. But when in 24 he decided to stop with Sufi orders, of course, Sufi orders started a transformation of themselves, because it's different if you can worship in a free way or become a sort of musical club, music and cultural tradition club from the Kalbatiya, from the Medleviya. So it's very... It was a risk. He took the risk, and today Sufi traditions continue to be followed in Turkey, but of course in an underground way, if I can say that.
I just find it fascinating. I mean, my own research has been this, is that this split between the world, in other words, politics and religion and the esoteric traditions, I believe, bridge that gap, and therefore they're the enemy. That's what I found very interesting. So they're the enemy of a state that wants to free the people from the fascism of religion, of exoteric religion. And on the other hand, they're persecuted by the Taliban, for instance. The Taliban really goes after them. So it's that middle ground, that boundary, that hermetic border that I find so interesting and unaddressed. And in the ancient Near East, the wisdom traditions were followed by the rulers and the princes of Palestine and Persia, and it was wisdom was considered part of politics in Judaism, it was wisdom was found at the city gate, and it was defined as life and clear perception, and so it was found at the found in politics, and so I just find that very very apparent, and I just wondered if that was addressed at all. Are there any Sufis who are who can retain their Muslim heritage and yet be express themselves? I guess in the creativity, so that's their only outlet. I guess that's my one pointer question. So in other words, creativity, the art. I think you said the poetry and the music and the dancing. That's how they bridge the this schism between politics and the mystical. Is that what you said?
I think it's finally it's a political question because Sufis that are considered more tolerant in Islam have always been persecuted since they existed. And I think because the inner significance of the mysticism is so powerful and other people that don't understand it, read only the letter, scared about what the spirituality could bring out from you, if I can say that. And finally, it's also a political question, of everyday life.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Is there any evidence in your research during this period of Sufism in Italy, and specifically in Sicily, are people who were members of, let's say, the Jewish or Christian religions and were also practicing Sufis? Is there any evidence of that?
I don't have any evidence.
You don't have any evidence? No?
For me, no. I'm not a specialist of the Middle Ages. I only read literature about that because my first interest was how Italian arrived to receive and Sufism and convert to Sufism. Mm-hmm. Because we have a lot of Sufi brotherhoods today who are composed by members that are only Italians. So, of course, we have another transformation of the traditional, of the Sufi tradition. Mm-hmm. And so I started from the Middle Ages and the Renaissance period is very interesting too, just to find some link in the history. But as I said, in this period, in the first Middle Ages, for example, it was very difficult to say that they should be called Allah, the Persian mystic that I mentioned, was condemned to death because he said, "Anam Haq, I'm the truth, so I'm God." Because Anam Haq, because he was during a sort of ecstatic experience, he said he it was not a comparison with God. In this moment, he was so in union with God that he said, I'm the truth. That means also I'm a part of this truth, huh?
Yes.
Because Sufism considered that we are all part of the divinity. So just because he said that, he was condemned to death, and many mystics like him. So I think that in the Middle Ages, it's difficult to find evidence because they were so persecuted also. But surely there were people that used to share their tradition and their mystical traditions too. And I think maybe they mixed them. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you.
Just one more question. You mentioned about literature. I was wondering if there were particular writers, and you also said that there wasn't very much written, but if there were specific poets or writers of Sufism in Sicily. Here in Sicily.
There were writers.
Yes, who were they?
There were some poets. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yesterday night we heard about some poets from Sicily.
Okay. Thank you.
So Rumi was exclusively Turkish.
All right.
Rumi. So if you look, Shahan is in Turkey, but he's the most famous poet in Turkey.